Okay, let's take a look. The second session we're going to look at, I've called The Rise of Cyberculture from Candyland to Broadband. That should be I'm way ahead here. It's on page 14. Page 14. And what I want to try to do here, I'm not a, I'm probably more geeky, computer geeky than some of you in here, but I really hope I'm not too much in that camp, although I know there's a need for that camp to exist. But I really want to preface what we're going to look at this session and what we're going to look at in the fourth session with this statement. And this is really important. I want you to listen to this very carefully. My criticism, my concern in everything that we're looking at today, and technology is no exception, but particularly technology, my criticism and my concern for the church is that we are living an unexamined life in a lot of these areas. And by that I mean we are not, we don't have a theological screen door on our lives where stuff can get stuck on it long enough for us to examine it. And this is going to make a whole lot more sense so as we go through this. But my passion and my concern is not technology per se. It's kind of the fact that we, of the last people on earth, we are the last people on earth that should live relatively uncritical and unexamined lives. And I think we have been. This is a statement from a guy that works for Barna. Technological change is happening all around us, but how often do Christian leaders and teachers, that's us, specifically address how to, now look at this, anticipate, interpret, and respond to technological innovation? The short answer is we don't. Short answer is we don't. As Americans, we are typically focused on the function that technology serves, particularly expediency and efficiency. But as Christians, have we sufficiently considered what expectations, both good and bad, technology creates and satisfies among its users? See, I'm almost banking on the fact that most of you sitting here this morning have never really thought that technology creates anything in us. And to the degree that you believe that technology is like a screwdriver, and you just get a good one, like a Craftsman that has a lifetime warranty, and you use it and know how to use it, you'll be a good steward. To the degree that you believe that, I say this because I love you, to that same degree, you are flat wrong and dangerously wrong. And you, the good news is, you are not alone. All right? So I hope I've kind of created a little bit of a bruise there. This guy just died 2 years ago. Anything this man has written is worth reading. Neil Postman, Musing Ourselves to Death, Education as a Subversive Activity, The End of Education as We Know It, Technopoly. To be unaware that technology comes equipped with a program for social change, to maintain that technology is neutral, to make the assumption that technology is always a friend to culture is, at this late hour, stupidity, plain and simple. 21 years ago, he wrote that. And I'll give you his books, the book titles and all the biblio stuff is in the. Don't you love this? Sometimes the people that push technology have been wrong. If you've ever heard of the Digital Corporation or Digital Equipment, they had a headquarters in Colorado Springs. This was Ken Olson who founded it. All right. So almost 30 years ago, he made a statement that he could never see any reason why anyone would want a computer in their home. All right. Obviously, couldn't envision the day when people would have a computer in their pocket or in their phone. Okay, I love Apple computers. But I got a real bone to pick with them on this. Apple Computer in 2003 made some statements about what they call digital kids. These are quotes off their website. They said that digital kids are hyper-communicators. They use many means to stay in touch with their peers and to access information about their world. Landlines, cell phones, pagers, PDAs, email, IMs, faxes, machines. 2003, they said that. They said, and it would make sense, that on a website that's selling computer technology and computer equipment, that they would say, this is good stuff. This is good stuff. Kids are getting connected. They are talking to one another. They are communicating with one another. They are multitasking. They see no problem watching TV, browsing the internet, listening to music, and communicating with their friends at the same time. All right? And you probably believe that's true. You probably believe that's true. Because you see it. And if you see it, obviously it's happening. Well, there's a report that came out the same year, the same month, by the National Commission for the Children on Risk. You need to sell your bed and buy this report. I'm not joking. It's not a religious report. There's medical doctors there from Harvard Medical School, Yale Medical School. David Blankenhorn, if you've ever read anything of his stuff, Fatherless America, he's on there. Christian Smith, a sociologist from UNC Chapel Hill, is on there. It is a riveting scientific study that has data in there that would, I mean, it will crank your tractor, I'm telling you. Here's what they said. Same year, same people, opposite conclusions. We're witnessing high and rising rates of depression, anxiety, attention deficit, conduct disorders, thoughts of suicide, and other serious mental, emotional, behavior problems among U.S. children and adolescents. Matter of fact, they found that the children of immigrants, the longer they're in the United States, the more toxified they become. There's something poisonous in our culture. They went on to say, in large measure, what is causing this crisis of American childhood is a lack of connectedness. We mean two kinds of connectedness. Close connections to other people. Now, I thought they were text messaging and IMing and connecting with all their friends. There's 70 million blogs in the world. Did you know that? Well, why is it as a high school teacher that I found kids that could pour out their guts to the universe but couldn't talk to someone across the lunchroom table? What was happening? What's happening? Why do more and more young people stare at the floor when you talk to them? Why do they not know how to look a person in the eye and just talk to them face to face? Well, let's take a look at a couple things here. I call this life in the matrix. Things that we should know as Christians. Number one is that since Genesis 3, my natural direction is away from God, not towards Him. You have, I have, we all have what I call the Adamic remnant. And beloved, it will be there until we get a new body. And there's a part of you and there's a part of me that wants to be on the fast train away from God. There's a part of you and there's a part of me that loves sin. If that's not true, I got to throw out almost all of Paul's writings. And mankind, fallen mankind, since Genesis 3, is on a movement away from God. That's very, very important. My natural passion is to envy the surrounding culture, not just to employ it. And in your hearts, you know this is true. And one of the things I don't believe I have in this in your notes. Let me see. Yeah, I do. What is true for me as an individual is true for humanity as at large. In other words, the human race is on a journey. Which direction? That's away from God. All right? Now, I hope you believe that. If you don't believe that, then a lot of what we're going to talk about the rest of the day may not make sense. And that's not a pejorative statement. I think it's a theologically true statement that we've lost track of. Another thing that's important is that this world is my house. I got to live here, but it's not my home. This isn't where I'm from. Now, this is not in your notes. I thought it was, but it's not. Let me just throw this out because I think it's important. If mankind is moving away from God, naturally moving away from God, I want you to hear this. That means that any innovation on the part of fallen humanity is going to be designed to make that journey more comfortable. Did you get that? It's absolutely a huge statement, and it's very, very important. If mankind is moving away from God, then creative innovation, and I'm thinking particularly of technology, made by fallen humanity, is going to do what it can to make that journey more comfortable. There is not a person on this planet who's in Adam but not in Christ that's going to invent something that's going to move me back towards God. And if I'm ignorant of that, and believe that technological innovation is just there, not that it's made by a human race that's moving away from God. Now, I know that I would probably get hung up and shot for saying this in some circles, but I believe it's true, and I think it's important. All right, let's take a brief history. We're going to fly through this. This, I don't think you need to write anything, and I've taken out about half the slides. These are important milestones. In about the 5th century B.C., the Ionic alphabet was adopted. Why is that important? Because it really marks the clear date when culture moved from being an oral culture to the beginning of a print culture. And that's a very, very important time. We moved from what we could call talking man to typographical man. Then we jump ahead 1,000 years with the invention of movable type in Europe. 1844, Samuel Morse invented the telegraph. Let me back this up. In 1844, he invented the telegraph. It was not too long after that that the Pony Express ended. The telegraph put the Pony Express out of business. In 1876, Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone. When he unveiled his telephone at the Philadelphia Science Exposition, the newspaper said that it gained less attention to the booth that was selling magic tricks next door. And there's no way on God's green earth that Alexander Graham Bell had any idea what he was giving birth to. No idea. You talk about the internet, you talk about cellular technology, you talk about everything. You know, the telephone's an integral necessity in the development of that. In 1896, the radio was invented. 1927, television. It's a beautiful set, isn't it? In 46 is when the post-war began to crank up TVs. Most homes didn't have them until about 1950. 1952, the VCR was invented. This is an enormous thing in terms of data storage, in terms of being able to manipulate images, things that you and I just consider status quo, like the instant replay on a sporting event. Weren't able to do that. If you look back at some of the old black and white movies, Laurel and Hardy, The Three Stooges, those guys did all their own stunts, and it was a one shot, one cut. That's how you do it. Didn't have the option of special effects and so on. In 1942, the first digital computer was invented. It's not exactly a high efficiency item. 1968, if you find this on the internet, you can actually see a video of this. The guy invented the first computer mouse. You know, Gates and Jobs are all pirates, and they stole all their ideas from all kinds of people in Silicon Valley. And I'll never forget when I was working, I was working for Nav Press one summer when I was in Colorado Springs, and I was on a plane flying out to Sacramento to meet with somebody for something, and I grabbed a computer magazine. This was about 1981 or so, and it was just lambasting Apple's Macintosh that was coming out because it used a mouse. And it said, which computer user in their right mind is ever going to want to use some cutesy little thing called a mouse? You know, and it got started actually way before that, 16 years before Apple released the Mac. ARPANET was founded in 1969 as an attempt on the federal government to connect think tanks on opposite sides of the country. It eventually gave birth to the internet. 1969, the compact disc was invented. There's a big debate over which of these three guys gets credit for it, but he's typically, Klaus Kompen is usually given the credit for this. More and more data, less and less space, more and more speed. Real important. There you go. I'm sure all of you have one of those in your pocket. Those were called bag phones in 1973, the first cellular technology. It was really a big deal to have one of these. 84, the Apple came out with the Mac, and their goal, which was interesting, was the end user, and they really wanted to make computing something that was enjoyable. It was a year later that Windows came out, and a big lawsuit, and Microsoft won. They always do. But pretty soon, everybody is working with what's called a graphic user interface. Icons, trash cans, recycling bins, all the things that you've come to recognize in computers came out of this era. I used one of these back when I was working for Nav Press. This was the original kind of laptop computer called the Osborne. I don't know if any of you have ever messed with one of these. It was had a huge screen there in the center. You can see that. So doing word processing, if you were a secretary or trying to write a book, obviously was just it was difficult. And a lot of people don't know this, but a guy named Tim Berners-Lee is the guy that came up with what's called HTML, hypertext markup language, which is really the computer language that's behind every web page you ever see. And in a very real sense is kind of responsible for giving birth to what we call the World Wide Web. That was in 1990, not too long ago. 93 was when Intel came out with their first Pentium processor, and I think they're up to, what are they, Pentium 5, 4? Not sure where they're at now. But as you see this, we go. Where do we go? Things changed as we went over time. I call this the dehumanization or the de-evolution of man, and I'll explain what I mean by this in a minute. We kind of had talking man back in prehistory, up through at least the 400 BC before the Ionic alphabet was adopted. And people, that's how they communicated, was verbally. Much of our Bible was passed on orally. And I'm sure some of it was written down. Higher critics, I think, have finally given in to the fact that Moses knew how to write. But we have, you got all these genealogies in the book of Genesis. Where did Moses get those? Who kept them? How did they keep them? They're just tremendous, tremendous oral knowledge. If you were a scribe, you memorized most of the Old Testament. You knew it from memory because of oral culture. Well, probably around 1450, with the invention of movable type, typographical man stepped onto the scene. And we're going to take a look at each of these people here in a second. I'm going to make man smaller and smaller as we go through this because I think there's a dehumanization process that's going on, and I'm hoping to be able to show that to you. Telegraphic man, big, big step. It may not seem important, but what happened with the telegraph is absolutely crucial to understanding what's happening in information technology today. Television man, about 1946, and then somewhere around 1990, we would get what I call terminal man, which is probably tongue-in-cheek. since the rise of the computer and since its invitation into your homes, there is no question in my mind that the people that know and love you have seen more and more of the back of your head than they did a decade ago. My wife has threatened to bury my laptop with me when I die. Okay, I want to go back and take a look at each of these people, talking man, and I want to present it to you on a couple different levels. Truth was was relational. Truth was relational. The credibility of the message and the speaker were linked because I, in an oral culture, I'm face to face with this person. I'm listening to him talk. And because learning was taking place in community, the credibility of the messenger was already verified by the fact that they lived with me. But learning was relational, which is really, really important. And truth was relational. There was a connection between the person bearing the truth and the truth that they bore. All right? Not unlike someone else we know whose name is Yahweh. John 1. Relating was firsthand. It was face-to-face. All right. There was no MP3s of Aristotle. When we get to typographical man, all of a sudden truth becomes propositional. It's dependent on words. And the written words determine the meaning, not the speaker. So I have to learn vocabulary. I have to understand what the words mean so that I can try to understand what the sentence means so that I can understand what the author means. And so in a sense, learning became reflective. It was your mind trying to connect with my mind, kind of a mental dialogue. That's why when people read books, and this has got to be true of every single person in this room, there has to have been a time in the last week when you read something where you took your eyes up off the page and you looked off and you thought. All right? And you pondered. We don't ever do that with a computer screen. I don't think. And we don't even read all that's on a page. They know how much we read. Relating became secondhand, author to reader, student to pupil, or teacher to pupil. All of a sudden, the book, if I'm a teacher, I'm not going to use my own book, more than likely, too much. I'll use someone else. Now I have the option of using someone else. So I'm taking their ideas and I'm teaching them to you. Even what we're doing right now is secondhand. Well, then when we get telegraphic man, truth is all of a sudden assumed. The credibility of the message is not easily verifiable. You get a telegraph, how do you judge if it's true or not true? Well, it has to be somehow connected to the credibility of the sender. And the sender is not there in your presence. So you have to assume that the sender sent the truth. And learning now is decontextualized. This is what I meant that is so important about the telegraph. With the invention of the telegraph, knowledge and information became decontextualized for the first time. All of a sudden, I could receive information from some other part of the world, some other part in space and time that I'm disconnected from. And over time, this began to be known as news. And the better the news was, the faster I got it and the further it traveled. And if you listen to the news broadcasters in this city, boy, they will tell you, breaking news story, you know, an exclusive that we have. All right? And 90% of it, if I can use a percentage, it's not news. It's not anything I need to know about. I really don't. But the decontextualization, the separation of the knower from what is known in space and time is a very important thing. Because all of a sudden, I'm connected to parts of the world and information that has very little bearing on my life. But somehow, I have access to it. And if you can get it to me, I guess I should have it. Relating became third hand, another's account told to a telegrapher. So I sit down and I say, here, write this. And the guy goes, ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. Now, if I already knew how to do that, I wouldn't have asked him to do that. So I'm assuming that what I'm dictating, he's typing accurately, and the person who's reading it's getting it accurately, and so the distance between you and me is becoming greater. We get to television man, and truth now is experiential. The medium and the message are linked. Now, how can I say that? Because you will not find a television show that has no music. The music tells you when to be sad. Music tells you when to get ready to be scared. The music tells you when to laugh. They even pump the laughter in so you know when to laugh in case you didn't get the joke. And the issue is an experience. That your television set now becomes an experience. And learning is reflexive, not reflective, but reflexive. There's no connection to real people. There's no connection to real places. I mean, sometimes there's real people and there's real places, but you and I have no connection to them unless you happen to see somebody that you know. And so it just is happening. Learning is just kind of happening. I'm just picking it up. It's just coming in. It's going out. And relating now is vicariously. Because the people I'm watching, more than likely, are not the people that they're portraying, right? You know, that's why let me give you a classic example of how this slides under our radar. You talk to people and they'll say, you know, there's this show or there's this movie and there's kind of a bad scene in it, but at least they're married. And I want to say, well, time out. They're not married. They're married in the script, but they're not married. And there's a word for watching other people engage in sexual activity. It's called voyeurism. But we would never say I'm voyeuristic. And yet none of us in this room would ever think to go look through our neighbor's window into their bedroom, and yet we have no problem doing that in front of us, right? And I'm not saying here's the shows you watch and here's the shows you don't watch. I'm just saying, you know, so much of this stuff just goes right past our radar, and you hear people say, well, at least they were married in the movie. Well, I like to say, well, at least they were portrayed as being married. But the scene you saw involved two people who are not married engaged in activity that's restricted to married people. And so there's this vicarious connection. I'm sure, I'm not going to die for this. I don't think I'd even get beat up for it. I'm pretty sure this is true, that the popularization right now, the almost obsession with reality television, has something to do with our desire to get connected or to somehow live out something by watching someone else. I mean, I can't think of any other reason for it. Even the whole American Idol thing is really about losers. It's not about winners. I mean, we all kind of wait for the one person to win at the end, but it really, in Survivor, it's all about who gets bumped off every week. You know, shows like 24, you can kill anybody now if you watch that show. I mean, they take lead characters and just, they're gone. And there's this vicarious connection where we're living so much more of our lives, I think, through television. Terminal Man, Truth Now, and this is essential. Beloved, truth becomes private. We've gone from an oral culture where truth was community and public to where truth is private. I determine the value and credibility of the message. I determine it. And learning is promiscuous. I stole this phrase from a guy named Quentin Schultz. His book is in the bibliography. And this, as an educator and this as a minister, is something that concerns me, is that people are becoming what Quentin Schultz calls promiscuous knowers. What do I mean by that? They learn everything the same. There's no hierarchy. Closest thing we get to a hierarchy of value for information online is what's called relevance. You do a word search, you use a search engine, Yahoo or Google or Ask Jeeves or whatever, and it lists the hits it gives you based on relevance, based on the words you've typed in. But there's nothing indigenous to the learning environment that says this is really worthwhile, this is not. Or this is really true, and this is not. I've got a slide and I'm not in there, but it took me 15 minutes to find out if this was true or not. I found a page on Amazon.com that had a video game called The Mega Church. And it was build your own church, get rid of the idiots you don't want, set up your own worship style. If you want a polka mass instead of a, you know, this and that, if you're from Wisconsin and you want this, do this. And it was this long. And it had $49.95 and a slash through it, limited time offer, and reviewers of this. I mean, it was an Amazon product with full customer reviews, and the entire thing was a spoof. Entire thing. And what was it that told me that it was a spoof? I mean, And it had Amazon logo. It was, I mean, if you, and I may have it buried in there someplace. I thought this, because I got kind of excited because I thought this is going to help my argument. And I tracked it down. I thought, this is a joke. Now, the sad thing is that someone would have a perception of the church that would cause them to do that. That's a whole nother topic, isn't it? Relating now becomes virtual, pixel to pixel. We're going to talk about this. This is what concerns me. And it's not for sociological reasons. It's not for neurological reasons. It's not for medical reasons. It's for theological reasons. When we get to this, the fourth session, I'm hoping to take you into some theological territory that it is really refreshing and I believe really bountiful and full. Okay, we jump into this a little bit further. And this is something that's important, is that every technology comes with an embedded set of values, has a certain perspective on power, and a set of beliefs about truth. What constitutes truth? How to get truth out? How to separate truth? Media technology in America has become inseparably wedded to capitalism and its top four values, and I've listed those for you. And it's driven by two myths, and we'll talk about that. Now, this is not me speaking. You can check anybody that's done their homework on this. The book that I would recommend, it's in the bibliography, so just if you can remember the name, this guy's name is Quentin Schultz. He's a Christian. He works, teaches at Calvin College. And he's written a book called Habits of the High-Tech Heart, Living Virtuously in an Age of Age of Information. That's in your notebook. I'll give it to you after lunch. And he makes some really strong statements that what's happening now is that the internet, particularly online virtual learning and information technology, has been basically hijacked by American capitalism. And everything that drives capitalism is now driving that. And these are some of the main values: consumerism, power, individualism, external beauty. Let me take you a little bit further. This is just some foundational stuff. We've been conditioned to view modern communication technologies as neutral and beneficent. What do I mean? I meant exactly what I said at the very beginning of this session. We have been conditioned to think of technology like we would a screwdriver or a power saw. If you work with wood or do any kind of hobby type stuff, the name DeWalt is a name that you would probably maybe like to own. Unless you're really in the next tier, then it's these names that no one's ever heard of that cost four times as much. Because you want a good tool. And we've kind of bought a bill of goods that's been fed to us very, very slowly about technology. It is not neutral. And it is not beneficent. Critical questions that should be asked and never are. Never are. All right, first one. What demands does this new technology make? What is required of me? You go into a CompUSA or a Best Buy or a Circuit City, and go into their computer department, and you will hear the most wonderful stories about what this technology will do for you. Or go to Verizon or T-Mobile or Singular. And they will tell you wonderful stories about what this technology will do for you. And if you start to ask them these three questions, I promise you that they will, their jaw will drop open. We just don't ask them. But every single technology is going to require something of you. What losses will result? What will it take from me? What will I not have as a result of having this technology? And I think it's fair to say that none of us in this room ask these questions. This one's more important. If I was to put a big star by any of the three, it would be this one. What transformations will result? What will it do to me? What will this technology do to me? I challenge you to ask a computer salesman that question and see if they even have a remote answer. What do you mean, what's it going to do? It's not going to do anything. It's going to do all this for you, all right? Now hang with me here. Hang with me. Let's take this. Modern culture, these are the two myths, the two religious pillars: speed and efficiency. If I can do things faster and I can do things better, then I ought to do them. And it's built on and fueled by instrumental technologies. I'm going to use that word a lot, instrumental and non-instrumental. Instrumental, for just in a nutshell, instrumental is measurable stuff. It's bandwidth, it's SAT scores, it's 100-yard dash times. It's things that can be measured. It's things that tend to serve me, and they tend to create a hierarchy of performance in our culture. Faster, better, richer, better looking, that sort of stuff. Acting, I mean, almost everything we have from national merit finalists down to the Grammys are all built around instrumental skills, all right? And technology fuels instrumental technology. Therefore, now this is really important. It's going to become increasingly difficult to develop or nurture non-instrumental virtues and practices. And I've got a whole seminar on this that I'm going to try to, it's on Tuesday and Thursday. I got about 6 hours worth of stuff to put into 75 minutes. But it's non-instrumental virtues, beloved, are things like mercy and compassion, neighborliness, listening, and as an educator, contemplation, contradiction. And the information technologies they work against all those things because they worship speed and efficiency. Taking time to reflect and taking time to think, there's no place for it in a fast bandwidth world. Let me just have you fill this in. This is pretty self-explanatory. I'm gonna jump over this so that we don't end up a little bit later. It's just a little paradigm on terms of the retreat from truth. We've kind of gone from truth to wisdom to knowledge to information to data. And data right now is annoying and irrelevant. Information is interesting and entertaining and impersonal. I'm going to make a passionate plea for you and I that we work our way backwards. Not that you burn your computer, you know, not that you throw your Trio into the garbage, but that or your BlackBerry, but that you understand the bigger picture of some things that have to do with our responsibility with the truth of God. All right, let me keep going here. Quentin Schultz says that modern technologies have created a new kind of religion. He calls it informationism. He says informationism is the faith in the collection and dissemination of information as a route to social progress and personal happiness. It's a reliance on this. It's the belief that it will make life better for me, it will make life better for everybody. Information. Matter of fact, information has become a new form of currency. And currency always produces power. So whoever controls the information controls everything. The more you have, the better you are, according to this religious view. Another guy wrote a book called Data Smog, and he says that modern technologies have created a new type of garbage. The character of information has changed. This is important. The character of information has changed as we've accrued more and more of it. Information has emerged not only as a currency, but also as a pollutant. I mean, why do we have to have spam filters? Why do we have to have spyware protectors? And who are these people that never work, but are able to generate all these crazy emails that they send out and, you know, or if you pray this prayer 6 times and turn around in a circle and send it to 10 people, you know, your stocks will go up. I mean, I get all this stuff. And it used to be, when ARPANET first started, it was the exchange of meaningful information. And what this guy, and this guy's not a believer, he just says that the character of the information is changing. All right, let me give you 7 modern myths about technology. We're going to fly through these. Number one, and this one's probably the biggest, that new technologies are additive and beneficial. This is a myth. The idea that technologies just add to culture. In other words, when the automobile came out, it was called, what was it called? Horseless carriage. And the thought was, we've just replaced the horse. All right? The automobile is the single factor that created the suburbs. And everything sociological, ethnic, economical that goes with suburban sprawl and white flight and all of that stuff has been facilitated by the automobile. So when you bring the automobile into American culture, you don't have America plus the automobile. You have a totally different America. All right? They're cultural catalysts. They're ecological. They're not additive. They change everything. They change everything. They transform all of culture, not merely improve some of it. When the printing press went into Europe in the 15th century, you didn't have just the Europe plus the printing press. You had a totally different Europe. Mechanical clock, 1300s. Listen to this. With the invention of the clock, eternity ceased to serve as the measure and focus of human events. And thus, though few would have imagined the connection, the inexorable ticking of the clock may have had more to do with the weakening of God's supremacy than all the treatises produced by the philosophers of the Enlightenment. That's a profound statement. Because it shifted the view of people from eternity to time. And when we've gone digital, it's gotten even worse. Because now you can subdivide time down into microseconds, nanoseconds. And what they're saying is that you didn't have just a culture plus a timepiece. You had a whole different culture, a whole different theology. Second one, new technologies are producing smarter people. That's not true. They're becoming promiscuous knowers. People who learn everything the same way. I had a student that I have a project where they have to do a hymn of a dead person. Person had to have been dead. I'm really into dead people. And they're more substantive, usually. And I said, find a hymn of someone who's dead, and then they had to work out a theology and figure out what where the doctrines were, and then they had to present it to the class, and then we sang it. And I had a kid come to me and said, I can't find a single thing on this person that you gave me. I've checked the entire internet. I reached up on my desk and handed him a book. And I said, here, try this again for the first time. You know, and it was because that everything's learned the same. There's no hierarchy. There's a huge difference between knowledge about someone and knowledge of someone. And we have lots and lots of people that know lots and lots of stuff. Information technology focuses on speed and efficiency. This is really important for us as Christians, beloved. The present and the future become more important than the past. Technology is always looking forward. Now, you can access the past if you want to know about it, but it's really not important. The present's important. Now is important. Live video streaming, having your phone chime and tell you whether or not your flight's on time. That's important. What happened in the 13th century, that's not important. And for us, that's not true. Fourth one. They produce intimacy because people are in touch more. Messaging is not conversation. Messaging is not conversation. We need to help our people, particularly our children, learn how to talk face to face. It's truncated, one-dimensional text. I'm not opposed to it. I use it. Hear me. I use it. But if I go out to eat with my wife, I go out to eat with somebody, my phone doesn't go on silent. It stays in the car. That's a whole other thing, beloved. We've lost the spheres in our life. You never leave work. God wants you to leave work. Leave your phone someplace. Leave it in the car. what's happening is that people really are starting to interact more and more with their self. This is, this quote's in your notes. This is from a book back in the 50s. It's talking about television. Physical reality seems to recede in proportion as man's symbolic activity advances. The more pictures, the more visual, the less physical contact. He's talking about television. The more we look at visual images, the more we look at images, the more we relate to images, the more we're constantly dealing more with ourselves than we are with other people. 50 years ago. Introduction to his book, Quentin Schultz's book. Cyberculture, listen to this, disconnects us from human communities in a particular temporal location. Real people in real places. It disconnects us from them, sharing an actual physical space, even as it connects us in thin ways to strangers. I got an email this week from a former student of mine that he said, I want you to read something I posted on MySpace. And it starts out, a letter to the world. This kid's 17 years old and he really believes the whole world's reading this. Or the whole world's interested in what he has to say. And I happen to know this kid. And he doesn't relate well to people, period. I'm not against blogs. They're not evil. The Antichrist doesn't have a Pentium processor, all right? It's just that we are watching this stuff transform us and not really thinking about it. Myth four, their values neutral. Modern technologies are embedded with a value system, much like the Trojan horse in Homer's Iliad. Consider the values that are promoted. Disposable cameras, plastic beverage containers, disposable DVDs. What's the value there? Do you know that modern minivans right now, I think at the Toyota Sienna, is that it? I think it has 11 or 12 cup holders in it. Campbell's has redesigned all their soups to be microwavable and fit in cup holders. The drive-thru, is it wrong? No, it's not wrong, but it has changed the way we do dinner. It's changed what we value. It's changed the way we relate to each other while we're eating. And to be ignorant of this as people in ministry, all I'm saying to be ignorant of this is probably wrong. Matter of fact, I went to, this is real quick, I've been to a couple habitat projects at Sandtown Housing Project in Baltimore. And I used to be an environmental chemist for 5 years, so I still have a passion for that sort of thing. And, it dawned on me, there's just broken glass everywhere in the projects, everywhere. And if glass bottles were refundable, if there was a deposit on them, I know for a fact it would be totally clean. Because people would do the same things they did when I was growing up. They'd take them in. I don't know what they'd spend the money on. That doesn't solve some of the social problems, but goodness sakes, there was just glass everywhere. Because glass is disposable, because of plastic, because we value expediency. The Matrix depicts our dilemma with technology. That's not true, if you've seen The Matrix. The best movie that depicts the questions that we should be asking is a crazy movie called The Gods Must Be Crazy. I don't know if you've ever seen it. Coke bottle drops out of heaven out of this airplane and lands in this Aboriginal village. And they try to figure out why God gave him this Coke bottle. And the whole movie is the leader of the tribe going to the ends of the earth to give God back the Coke bottle because they have concluded that they do not want this technology because of what it's done to their tribe. I'm going to quit. We have to, I think, don't we? Or do you want to? It's 5 after 12. Give me 5 more minutes. I'm going as fast as I can. I'm sorry. How technologies are used should be the primary concern of Christians. That is not listed in your notes as a myth. I think it is that you and I, our primary concern should be how we use technologies. And the answer to that is no, that's not what our primary concern should be. Number one, I should be concerned about whether my faith is shaping my use of technology or vice versa. Which one's shaping which one? Question, how much of my spiritual formation is dependent upon electricity? How much of your walk with God in private needs electricity? How much of it involves a walk How much of it involves solitude? How much of it involves quiet? How much of it involves the scriptures? How much of it involves reading the old saints? John Chrysostom. Or how much of it is spent? I mean, I have heard stories even of seminary students in my wife's mentoring class. What do you do for devotions? Well, I listen to a praise tape on the way to school. I crank up the stereo. I do this. And beloved, there's, and we're going to talk about this later, but there's a place where my faith needs to shape my use of technology, not the other way around. Second one, I need to be aware of how technology is shaping my view of time and eternity. You know, how important are speed and efficiency to me? Do I think in terms of eternity? Do I? We've got a culture squeezing us in the opposite direction. And as those that are leaders, those that are in ministry, parents, pastors, whatever, I've got to help people think in terms of eternity. Third question, third statement. How about how technology is shaping the amount of time I spend with people? How many face-to-face conversations have I had this week that are not work-related? The phrase face-to-face, if I could, I'd tattoo that on the inside of your eyelids. It's kind of a high school phrase, but it's a good image because it's really, really important. When we get to the fourth session, we're going to talk about that. Powerful statement by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a book worth reading, even though it's almost 70 years old. Life Together. Many people are looking for an ear that will listen. They do not find it among Christians because these Christians are talking, texting, typing, surfing, whatever, where they should be listening. But he who can no longer listen to his brother will soon no longer be listening to God either. He will be doing nothing but prattle in the presence of God too. This is the beginning of the death of the spiritual life. One who cannot listen long and patiently will presently be talking beside the point, and never be really speaking to others. This goes back to what I mentioned in last and closing. Beloved, an instrumental virtue, a non-instrumental virtue is listening. And it's one of the hardest things to teach because you can never really see someone doing it. People just know when they've been heard. But you can't ever say, no, honey, look, you see that? See that guy right there? He's really listening. And I'm convinced, and we'll get to this in the fourth session, I'm convinced that we could be really on the bubble of some of the most amazing ministry opportunity in a long, long time that we might miss because we haven't just taken the time to assess how culture is shaping us. So, particularly in the area of technology, right? Now, we're going to jump ship after lunch and we're going to talk about this whole idea of biblical identity. Because I think we've got to get back to figure out who in the world we are. Then fourth session we're gonna look at, it's called You Can't Google God, and it has to do with technology and theology and ministry. And then the last session is hopefully I will have won some of your hearts by the end because we're gonna talk about some heavy stuff the last session. Kind of the practical thing, I've grabbed a quotation from a guy named Robert Weber, and the last session is entitled That the Road to the Future Leads Through the Past. So let me close in prayer, and I'll also, if you're okay, I'll pray over the meal, and then we won't have to deal with that awkward sort of thing in the lunchroom. Father, thank you so much for this time, and Lord, for these folk, and Lord, I believe there's a weariness in our souls as we try to juggle all this because we are people of responsibility. We are people who care. And Lord, so much of what we've studied has gone past the minds of a lot of people and their awareness. And Lord, what to do with this is it could be a wearisome task. And I pray, oh God, I really do, that you would winnow my words. Winnow my words. Lord, separate for each person here the worthwhile from the worthless, the useful from the useless. Lord, that which brings life from that which brings death. Lord, we worship you as a sovereign God. That, Lord, as Babylon rose, as Rome rose, as Assyria rose, Father, you always said that by a great army a king is not saved and a war horse is a vain hope for victory. But, Lord, you are with those who fear you, and we are those folk. And so, Lord, we are hopeful. We are grateful to be a part of the kingdom of light, and pray that we could walk as children of light, whatever that means in our respective spheres. We thank you for the nourishment of this food. Pray that we could enjoy it. And Lord, that the strength that's in it would somehow find its way back into your kingdom. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay.